This is Local Motion on KVNF. I'm Gavin Dahl. This week, a 420 edition, starting with Kate Redmond's interview of attorney Brian Vicente. 9 years ago, he co-authored Amendment 64, which voters approved, legalizing marijuana and setting up a framework for retail here in Colorado. Plus, I'll talk with journalist Leland Rucker about the evolving views of public officials and voters over the years, a recent study on the impacts of cannabis use on job performance, and which Western state will be next to legalize weed. It's a 420 Local Motion on KVNF. Stay tuned.
In November 2012, Colorado voters passed Amendment 64, which legalizes marijuana possession for adults under state law and required the state to establish a regulatory structure for retail marijuana. Today in Local Motion, I'm speaking with attorney Brian Vicente, who is one of the primary authors of Amendment 64. He is a partner in the law firm Vicente Sederberg in Denver, specializing in cannabis law and shaping policy in the cannabis and hemp industries. There were many aspects of the marijuana legalization campaign that were unique. Foremost, that it was passed as a state constitutional amendment. What led your team to this approach over a more statutory path?
So our thought at the time, and I was one of the lead drafters and co-managers of that campaign, was, basically marijuana had been illegal for adult use for 100 years, and we really didn't trust the government to not fiddle with a ballot measure that was more statutory. It's worth noting that Colorado passed medical marijuana in the year 2000, and that was a constitutional measure as well. So there really was some precedent for addressing constitutional issues related to cannabis in the state constitution.
Another aspect of the campaign was that the revenue from retail sales was earmarked and codified in the amendment. Can you talk about that?
Correct. So the way we drafted the measure is the first $60 million tax revenue annually goes into essentially public school construction, which could also be technology upgrades, things of that nature. And it's worth noting Colorado sort of wildly exceeds $60 million every year and has brought in closer to $1 billion since the onset of these laws in 2012. So a significant amount of funding for public schools, but also for a lot of other social services around the state.
Many detractors at the time believed that because cannabis is still illegal at the federal level, that we would face years of judicial challenges and complicated lawsuits. Despite being in conflict with federal law, Colorado went ahead and passed Amendment 64 at the ballot box with 55% voter support. Did you anticipate a clampdown by the feds?
Marijuana was then and does continue to this day to be illegal at the federal level. So for us, as those who felt like the government's prohibition system around marijuana was not functioning, the best way to sort of address that was to try to do so at the state level and the local level. And we went ahead and changed those laws. That was a direct, created a direct conflict with federal law. But ultimately, the federal government basically took a hands-off approach and said, as long as individuals are following state law and not acting outside of those laws, selling to kids or something like that, shipping across state lines, these marijuana laws should sort of be allowed to experiment and see what works for the state.
So then President Obama basically decriminalized cannabis at the time?
Marijuana is still illegal at the federal level. So it's still not only a Schedule I controlled substance at the federal level, which means it's among the most dangerous substances out there, which is, of course, not true, but that's where it sits. It's also illegal in the federal criminal code, but essentially what the Obama administration did is they had the Justice Department release a memo, and the memo said, hey, we could still, come and arrest you, but this is really going to be, essentially a low priority for us, and, we're not interested in interfering in these state programs.
One major hurdle that retail cannabis businesses have faced is the reluctance of banks to have anything to do with them because it is still illegal federally. Has that improved at all over the last 9 years?
That's been a difficult issue. So in a place like Colorado, where you have hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars generated from these cannabis businesses every year, that money needs to be put into a bank account in order to not only provide for community safety, so there's not large amounts of cash laying around, but also for transparency, right? We need to track these things to make sure nothing, no funny business going on. And within the last several years, the federal government has said, you know, they've issued memos saying that banks can work with state legal cannabis businesses. They'll just have to follow some somewhat onerous reporting requirements, suspicious activities reports, and so forth. But a lot of banks, unfortunately, just being sort of conservative institutions, have chosen not to work with these state legal cannabis businesses, whether they're medical marijuana or adult use. So, you know, many businesses in Colorado, cannabis businesses have banking status. Many of them don't. So it's really an issue that we need some, a little more reform on.
Has retail industry responded by forming alternative banking solutions? How have businesses handled this?
We fielded a fair amount of calls from people maybe wanting to start their own bank or create these alternative payment structures. By and large, we've had credit unions, you know, have stepped up to work with cannabis businesses. There are, you know, a couple dozen banks around the country that will openly work with cannabis businesses. And then there's a fair amount of banks that sort of look the other way and allow them to come through the door. So it's an imperfect system, and we really need the federal government to sort of, again, issue memos saying this is okay. And ultimately, we need the federal government to just legalize marijuana, which would remove the stigma for these conservative banks, but we're getting there.
After Amendment 64 passed that you helped write, did you receive a lot of phone calls from other states wanting consultations?
That was one of the really interesting and surprising things about, you know, when Colorado became the first place to legalize marijuana, 2012, our phones just rang off the hook. It was individuals from around the country and around the globe saying, hey, you know, I work in state government, federal government in Mexico, New Zealand, Germany, wherever. I'd like to come out and meet with you guys. I'd like to meet with law enforcement and the governor's staff too, and kind of just generally hear about this alternative to cannabis prohibition, which of course at that point was the worldwide policy, right? And Colorado sort of stepped out and said, we're going to try something different. And that was of really great interest to a lot of policymakers.
There were also detractors at the time that were from employer councils and chambers of commerce who said that this would spell disaster for workplaces. Has this played out?
I think by and large that, you know, we have seen that Colorado continues to be a great place to work. We have, you know, companies large and small moving here, and employers really retain the right to have whatever workplace policies they want around marijuana. In general, our view is we should treat it like alcohol, you know, the same way we don't want people impaired or consuming alcohol at work. That same rule should apply to cannabis. And you know, we've really seen that businesses have thrived. And then we've actually seen some interesting studies recently that in states that have medical marijuana programs, which of course Colorado does, workplace absences and accidents have gone down, which they're theorizing is because people have an alternative to opiates in those states. And instead of having opiates, which maybe will be addiction or might not show up for work the next day because you're dealing with some opiate hangover or whatever, you know, or, you know, medical cannabis has really provided an alternative, which in many ways has made workplaces better places.
Do you have any reflections looking back on the campaign and the ballot measure to legalize cannabis?
It's really fascinating to look back. I mean, Colorado really took a brave step forward in 2012 and said, we're going to try an alternative to the war on drugs. And no one really knew what would happen. Would the federal government parachute in here with the DEA and arrest people or what have you? But really what we've seen is, you know, we've seen job production and tax revenue in Colorado. We've seen towns that didn't initially support cannabis, like Grand Junction and Peonia, are now supporting it, allowing for these businesses. And then that has rippled out. And now we have 18 states with legal marijuana. Colorado was the first, but we have 18 other states, including New York and Virginia and these, you know, diverse and different but populated states and other countries, right? Canada as well. So I really think, you know, it's put Colorado on the map in some ways. And we've really, you know, served as a model for the globe on how you can have alternative marijuana policies.
Do you think that the amendment has helped or hurt small growers in the state?
Generally, I like to think it helped them in that they could now not fear going to jail for doing what they are so skilled at and could go ahead and work for either start a legal grow themselves or work as a farmer or a cultivator for a larger company. And I know tens of thousands of Coloradans now have those legal jobs. So I think that's important. They're no longer threatened to go to jail. Are there some underground individuals that have been displaced? Quite possibly, you know, but my hope is that those individuals would migrate into the regulated cannabis workplace and pay taxes like the rest of us.
Were there any unintended consequences or things that have surprised you after legalization?
You know, there have been some interesting things. You know, we certainly, you know, we didn't predict how big edibles would be and concentrates. You know, I think it's important that we do education around both those substances just to make sure people know that here's how you can consume them safely and here's could happen if you take too much. And of course, no one ever dies from cannabis, but you can be very uncomfortable. So some things of that nature, I have been, again, surprised by how over the years the stigma has started to go away and other communities are really adopting these laws in other states too.
It seemed to me at the time that you had a lot of support from people over 70 and that they benefited from being able to walk into a dispensary and be able to buy cannabis legally. Is that what your numbers showed?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, we did a fair amount of polling and exit polling, right, to see who were our supporters so we could message to those who were on the fence and, you know, make sure our supporters got out. And the sort of general breakdown is, you know, anyone 40 and under supports legalization, right? And then as you kind of go up from there, yeah, as you get into older populations, their support was not really there. They were more conservative of this sort of reefer madness mindset. So we didn't get that many votes from sort of, you know, more elderly citizens in 2012. But what we've seen has been very, very interesting is this shift where now every age demographic supports legalization, actually supports medical marijuana by a giant margin, but they also support legalization by a majority. And then we're one of the fastest growing demographics of cannabis consumers is actually senior citizens, right? So previously it was a lot of people in their 20s and 30s consuming cannabis, but now it's really a lot of more, you know, senior folks that are using it for medical purposes or perhaps just for wellness.
Thank you, Brian, for talking with me today. Do you have any further thoughts?
Yeah, I guess the one thing I would point out too, and this could be relevant to our kind of listeners on the Western Slope is, you know, one of the things that Colorado did in 2012 when we were the first ones to step out in this space is we also legalized hemp production. So hemp, of course, is the same plant as marijuana. It's all the cannabis plant, but it has much, much lower THC level. And it can be used for all sorts of industrial purposes and sort of wellness purposes with CBD and things of that nature. And that really has spread like wildfire. I mean, you look around the country, you can buy, you know, CBD in gas stations in Indiana. I mean, these places that you never thought you would see a marijuana derivative or marijuana product. And I think, you know, when we look back in another 10 years, Colorado voters supporting hemp legalization, which again made us the first place to do that formally at the state level, that could be viewed as a massive impact in terms of just having more sustainable industry and products and, you know, these wellness products that come out of hemp. So I think the marijuana and the adult use and medical stuff is really interesting, but the hemp really might be the long-term impact that people maybe don't see coming.
I've been speaking with Brian Vicente, partner with the Vicente Sederberg Law Firm. Attorney Vicente helped draft Amendment 64, which in 2012 pioneered cannabis legalization and regulation in Colorado. I'm Kate Redmond. Vibe in the middle of the sky and it's high, I don't want it to be over. This type of vibe rarely ever comes around, so this high, I don't want it to be over. Caught a vibe in the middle of the sky and it's high, I don't want it to be over. Keep me up on cloud nine, cloud nine.
Our next guest on this 420 edition of Local Motion is journalist Leland Rucker. He has written about cannabis for many years, including for Boulder Weekly, Sensi Mag, and now The News Station. He's also a beloved DJ at KGNU in Boulder. Thanks for speaking with KVNF, Leland.
It's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Let's start by talking about how the so-called mainstream in Colorado has shifted since voters approved recreational marijuana here back in 2012. The Denver Post, for example, published editorials encouraging no votes on Amendment 64 when legalization was on the ballot, then quickly changed their tune, cashing hundreds of thousands of dollars in advertising checks after weed was legalized. Of course, others have taken longer. Voters in Grand Junction this month repealed their ban on retail marijuana following other communities in KVNF's listening area, Paonia and Cedar Edge, where retail shops are coming soon. After he won his race for U.S. Senate last November, you wrote about John Hickenlooper's checkered record on Mary Jane for the news station. Quote, while Hick is known as a friend of beer, he still has to prove himself as a friend of cannabis. Talk about why.
Well, you know, there was a lot of opposition in Colorado, in the legislature, and from the governor when it was passed. But as we've seen, that's all changed. Now, cannabis is not a Democratic thing at all. It's not something that only Democrats. There's Republicans who are bringing bills to the legislature now, too. And I think that a lot of people had to change their minds, and they have. We can kind of expect that if a bill comes that Hickenlooper is going to have to pass or reject, and there's going to be some bills that are going to come into the Senate, I think he's going to go ahead and probably go with the majority and pass them.
You know, he used to use those same old talking points, calling cannabis a gateway drug. So what do you make of his transformation? Is it just in response to the will of the voters, or do you think he actually got more informed? And does that represent how other people's ideas and views have changed?
Oh, I think it definitely represents how a lot of people's views have changed. And I think that definitely his views have changed. I mean, he was definitely against it at the beginning. And he has said on a number of occasions that he was wrong, you know, that a lot of the things that he thought might happen didn't happen. And, you know, the rollout was a lot better and a lot easier than he thought as well. And I think that he, like so many people in so many legislatures, have finally come to the same conclusions as a lot of their constituents.
You also wrote that his website says marijuana sales have helped to fund educational opportunities for kids, helped repair rural schools across Colorado, created entrepreneurship opportunities where there used to be black markets. So it does also seem like he's fully adopted the here's what we can do with the money argument for legalization.
Oh, I think he's completely down with that. I mean, I could remember people kind of sniffing at the fact that the state was only getting $250,000 in sales tax for a year and that wasn't very much. Now it's up to $387,000, but that's a lot of money. I mean, that's a lot of money, and a lot of that goes to a lot of educational things. Otherwise, that money just wouldn't be available. And I think that he understands that, and I think a lot of people in the legislature understand that as well.
So thinking about the changing views of marijuana in the public, I was interested to read your story for the news station about a study that challenges the myth that stoners are lazy or useless. I know some of these studies can be a bit obscure, but tell us about this one. It's pretty interesting.
You know, this is one of those things that's been going on for a long time. It's one of those arguments that's been going on for a long time is that, you know, there's somehow or other something wrong with stoners. You know, it's in the mainstream, you know, magazines and newspapers and movies have all portrayed the stoner. But basically, this study says that, you know, we think a lot of times about when people use cannabis. And this study decided to find out when people use it, and then they went to their bosses and talked to them about their job performance. And what they basically found out is not really that revelatory, because anybody who's drank and smoked marijuana knows this, is that we use alcohol to relax, and people go home at nighttime and they drink maybe too much alcohol, and then the next day they're not as productive as they could have been. Whereas people who go home and smoke marijuana don't have that hangover, and that can really affect affect an awful lot of performance among people. And I think that this is the first study that really looks at those performance issues and comes to a different conclusion than a lot of the negative things that are said about stoners these days.
So that was research from Auburn University and San Diego State in the journal Group and Organizational Management. Do you feel like legalization will bring more research that will allow us to have a better understanding of the reality of these impacts?
You know, more research is necessary. The government is, the federal government is giving up just a little and allowing some research. There's still a lot of problems with that. The researchers always say, we want somebody else to do the same thing and find out if they come up with the same or different answers. And I think that we have to remember that we're still at the beginning of the research era when it comes to marijuana. After a 100 years of demonization, we got a long way to go there too.
My guest is journalist Leland Rucker, who writes for the news station, is also a beloved DJ at KGNU in Boulder. You're tuned to a 420 edition of Local Motion on KVNF. I'm Gavin Dahl. When pot shops first opened in 2014, there was a new kind of writing job available at the Denver Post and elsewhere as weed critic. Did you ever get into writing strain reviews, Leland?
You know, that's an interesting question, Gavin. I actually went to the Denver Post. Ricardo Baca was the editor at that time. He was the very first editor of their cannabis section. And I said that, you know, I wanted to write for him, and he asked me to do strain reviews. So I did one. He gave me an assignment, and I did one. And I wrote the review. I sent it to him. And then the next day I wrote to him and said, you know, I can't do this because this is almost like reviewing records, and I just can't do that. Besides that, I don't have that much differentiation between indica and sativa, so it's going to be pretty hard. And I've never done a strain review ever since. I do understand that if you come, you know, if you're a younger person and you began smoking cannabis by knowing the difference between indica and sativa, that's going to make a difference in how you react to those things or how you see how you react to those things. But for many of us who have been smoking marijuana for a longer period of time, I never knew what indica and sativa was until 2014.
We do have some listeners who haven't tried it. I don't know how many, but so for those who are not sure what we're talking about, some people can't smoke sativa strains because they might cause paranoia. Others don't like indica strains. They put them to sleep, you know, make them lethargic. In any normal dispensary, THC levels vary widely from a low THC strain, like say 10% THC, to the more potent flowers in the 25% range. Then, of course, there are many varieties of concentrates, not just hash, but wax, shatter, etc. Given the context of, you know, talking about regulations for retail, what's your take on the concept of the government determining a level of allowable potency?
That's kind of like telling a farmer, don't grow your best crop. And that doesn't make any sense at all. I mean, there's an attempt to cap potency. There was an attempt in the legislature in Colorado during this session. It hasn't gotten very far because capping potency, it's not really solving any kind of a problem. Nobody has come up with any kind of a study or any real evidence that potency is really an issue. Actually, the University of Colorado did a study last year where they were looking at that, and they found that people who used higher concentrates, the concentrated oils, that products that are made with concentrated oils, that they used less. And I think that that's kind of the point, is that, again, it's going to affect everybody differently, but there's no evidence at all that higher potency causes problems with people.
So I mentioned at the start of our conversation that voters in Grand Junction, Paonia, and Cedar Edge have approved retail marijuana, and shops are expected to open in all three locales this year. I'm sure you, like many others, were surprised to learn that Grand Junction has legalized weed.
pleasantly so.
You've written a four-part series for the news station on legalization and decriminalization efforts around the country. I know a lot is changing rapidly, so you know, as soon as you put out your guide, something changes the next day. But let's talk about, real briefly here, the states in the West without legal marijuana. So that's New Mexico, Hawaii, Idaho, Utah, and Wyoming. There's already some change afoot.
Yeah, New Mexico is not one of those states any longer. Just last week, it became the 17th state to legalize cannabis use for adults. Idaho, I think, will be the last state to finally legalize. Its legislature is trying to even stop the initiative process from happening because there's going to be an initiative in Idaho in 2022, as there are in many states, and they're going to pass. And I think that's what's leading a lot of legislatures to begin thinking about legalizing themselves rather than waiting for an initiative to happen and then having to deal with that. Pew just put out a survey that was just released yesterday that says that 90% of Americans are in favor of cannabis, whether it's recreational or medical. I'd say that legislators should start listening and paying attention to this.
Virginia, New York in the news this spring for legalization efforts. When do we talk about it at the federal level again? Is there a chance that marijuana is moved out of Schedule 1, you know, listed as a deadly narcotic? And is there movement to decriminalize or legalize through Congress?
Well, you know, Congress, the House last year passed a couple of bills that would legalize cannabis. They got nowhere in the Senate because of the majority leader at the time, who is now the minority leader. Representative Nadler has said that he's going to bring the MORE Act back to the House again and have the House vote on it again, and then they'll send it to the Senate, and the Senate's going to actually react because of the Democrats are now in charge, and they can bring bills to the floor. And Charles Schumer has already announced that he's going to bring his own bill, which has been co-done with Cory Booker and a couple of other people. He's already said that he's going to bring that to the federal level. Now, I think that if a bill were to go to President Biden, who hasn't been that enthusiastic about cannabis, I think that he'll sign it simply because that's the right thing to do. I think that definitely the tide has turned, and we're going to start seeing more states. I mean, 17 states now and a series of territories. And I think that that's going to change in 2022 dramatically.
You're tuned to a 420 edition of Local Motion on KVNF. My guest is journalist Leland Rucker. Before we go, I just want to ask about your marijuana pop-up book, Dimensional Cannabis. Is it still in print? How can people get a copy?
It is still in print. And if you just type in pop-up cannabis, you'll find that book because there isn't any other one. And the actual website is marijuanapopup.com. It's a lot of fun.
Leland Rucker, thanks so much for speaking to KVNF.
Thank you, Gavin, for having me. You know, I like to speak up and act up. Still jiggy with the rich life, Rasta. Keeping busy with the cha-cha, cha-cha. But I still taste you all my time. Run for cover. Red jacket, this is thriller. I know the flavor. Blue magic, you're my dealer. You know I like to speak up and act up. Still jiggy with the rich life, Rasta. Keeping busy with the cha-cha, cha-cha. But I still taste you on my tongue. Maybe this 405 will run you out my mind. Maybe this flashing lights will help me escape myself. You know I like to speak up and act up. Still jiggy with the rich life, Rasta. Keeping busy with the cha-cha, cha-cha. But I still taste you on my tongue.